got the Jeep down. Strolled along home and I went to bed. Well, I laid my pistol up under my head.
He strolled along home.
I took my time.
And he went to bed.
Thought I'd sleep some.
Laid his pistol.
Big 22.
Up under his head.
I keep it handy. Well, early in the morning, about the break of day, I figured it was time to make a getaway. Stepping right along, but I was stepping too slow. Got surrounded by a sheriff down in Mexico.
He was stepping right along.
I wore a hot foot knit,
but he was stepping too slow.
It was a sultry day.
Got surrounded by a sheriff.
Boxed
in Mexico.
I didn't even have a chance to see the country. When I was arrested, didn't have a dime. The sheriff says, son, you're right free this time. Where you're going, you don't need a cent. Cause the great state of Texas won't pay your rent.
Cause where you're going,
I think he means jail.
You won't need a cent.
Well, he knows I'm broke.
Cause the great state of Texas,
yippee,
gonna pay your rent.
I'm mighty grateful, fellas. Well, I didn't have a key, and I didn't have a file. Naturally, I stayed around until my trial. Judge was an old man, 93, and I didn't like the way the jury looked at me.
Well, the judge was an old man,
too old,
93,
entirely too old. I didn't like the way the jury looked at me. I think they were suspicious.
The judge and the jury, they did agree. They all said murder in the first degree. The judge said, say,
I don't know whether that here killing of deputy sheriff has just naturally got to stop.
You got a point there, Judge.
It was a most unsatisfactory trial. They gave me 99 years on a hard rock pile. 99 on hard rock ground. All I ever did was shoot the deputy down.
99.
It could have been life
on the hard rock pile.
They might have hung me.
And all he ever did was shoot the deputy down.
Bang, you're dead.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. On a beautiful day here in the Midwest, we got clear sky and sun. It's running about 40 degrees. That's not bad for this kind of time of year. Yeah. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. 46581, and I think just about everybody's got their donation in because it's running late. I got to start trimming a couple three out of there that haven't been keeping up with things. So anyhow, that's let's see, what is today? Well, this last week they've been celebrating and commemorizing the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Well, you know, in the old days, when I was a right winger and saw things totally in that way, I used to think he was a pretty good guy. But the more I got to studying Abraham, old Abe, Ahab on the Potomac, I've come to the conclusion, John Wilkes Booth was quite a guy. Sort of a lone wolf. He did have some help, but he did the job himself, because Abraham Lincoln was, at the bottom line, responsible for the death of about 700,000, mostly white Americans. Now, sure, you can say, well, the South was in on that, and they were killing. But Lincoln had every opportunity not to get into that war, not to start that war, even when they fired on South Fort Sumter, because they were running out of food on Fort Sumter, and they were going to have to vacate Fort Sumter anyhow, the Federals. But they had some boats coming with food and stuff to restock them. But the point is that the firing on Fort Sumter didn't have to start the Civil War. And for what would cost for 1 week of warfare in the Civil War, they could have paid off every black in the South, every slave in the South, for a reasonable amount of money. Just bought them from the slave owners and then shipped them back to Africa. But no, no. And also, Lincoln's responsible, his aftermath, for the 13th Amendment and the 14th. 13th and 14th. 14th is definitely illegal, unconstitutional. The 13th gave the vote to the black men. Well, guess what? That was on the 13th Amendment. Gave the black men the vote. Well, guess what? White women didn't get to vote till what? The 20s in this country? Isn't that a shame? These white men would give black niggers, ex-slaves, the vote 100 years, maybe not quite 100 years before white women. So think about that. One of the things that our race has been guilty of. Anyhow, I've come to look at it quite a bit different. It pisses me off a little bit at Russia, because Russia sent their imperial fleet over here to New York City and also to San Francisco to back up the Federals in the Civil War. And I used to think that was such a nice thing, but I don't think it was anymore, and it wasn't any of Russia's business, the Tsar's business, to do that. So, and also we're commemorating, I'm not, but the dummies out there commemorating the start of the Vietnam War, another crazy-ass criminal war where 50,000 U.S. citizens died, plus probably a couple of million Vietnamese died. What did that gain us? At the time, we were worried about Vietnam and using the communism as the excuse. We should have been thinking about China back then, that early on, if we were worried about anything like that. And remember, it wasn't too long till Nixon went over there and put the corporations in power, brought the corporations to China, and started this whole thing to where China's rebuilt their country and done all kinds of good things over there for their people. Yeah, which took away from our people. And so they're commemorating that, too, the idiocy of the Vietnam War. There's some other stuff they're talking about, but I don't have it in my little hand right at the moment. Well, guess what? We better give a call to Harold Covington with his Northwest Imperative and alert him to the fact that a little town in northern Idaho has just elected all-Mexican city council. How about that? Come on, Harold. You better get over there and take care of that stuff. And you know, we have some new Mexican film directors now making some more race-mixing white guys are bad back in history. Yeah. They're going to make all the white guys back in history bad. Yeah, that's what you get when you bring in movie directors from Mexico. Well, on this Christmas Eve, let's get back into our pessimist guide to history. Isn't that fitting for the night before Christmas? Day before Christmas. 1729, Constantinople fire. More than 7,000 people died and 12,000 buildings were decimated in a great fire. 1729, capital of the Ottoman Empire. Fire struck again in 1750, destroying 20,000 buildings. In 1756, burning 15,000 buildings. And in 1782, leveling 10,000 buildings. Not enough firemen or too many arsonists. Yeah. The Ottoman Empire. Well, that's what ISIS wants to rebuild. The Caliphate. The Caliphate. Well, it's the Arab part of the world. I can't blame Arabs for wanting an Arab for them, you know. We want a white nation for us. 1731, deadly earthquake rocks Beijing on November 30th. Peking, now Beijing, China, was struck by a massive earthquake that demolished much of the city and killed about 100,000 people. Mother Nature don't mess around, boy. 1732, 500 drowned as a ship sinks off Mexico. As a small fleet of Spanish ships carrying a cargo of mercury arrived off the coast of Veracruz, Mexico. The galleon Nuestra Señora de Concepcion unexpectedly floundered and sank, killing hundreds. Mercury is a highly toxic metal element. No estimates regarding the number of dead fish are given. Wow. 1737, cyclone and earthquake demolished Calcutta. October was a terrible month for the sprawling, overcrowded city. Let's see, where are we at here? Wait a minute. I lost my place. Well, let's go to 1732. Well, no, we saw that. 1735 to 1740, diphtheria outbreak hits New England, primarily striking children. The diphtheria epidemic that began in 1735 raged throughout New England for 5 years. In some of the towns, the deadly disease killed 80% of the children under 10 years of age. Well, when I was a little kid, there was still some diphtheria around. I remember that. 1737, cyclone earthquake demolishes Calcutta. That's where I was. October was a terrible month for the sprawling, overcrowded city of Calcutta, India. Located on the Bay of Bengal, the city was struck by a cyclone on October 7th that sent a 40-foot tidal wave, tsunami, crashing ashore. Some 300,000 people died in the disaster. And just days later, on October 11th, another 300,000 were killed when an earthquake rocked the ruined city. These disasters must have, however, alleviated some of the overcrowding. Yes, yeah, right, overcrowding. Well, that's all the pessimism I can handle for this hour. I'm going to get into more later. Just hang in there. And remember, if I don't offend you today, tune in tomorrow and make sure I offend you tomorrow. I mentioned the other day about the atrocities that the Wehrmacht, the German military, handed out in Russia. Well, you got to understand, now they've got it up to 27 million Russians died. And if you don't think a lot of that was atrocities, I don't know what to tell you. You're living in a la-la land. There's a couple of books out on it now, but of course the right wing in this country tends to want to put the Wehrmacht beyond reproach. Well, I'm sure there were plenty of brave, honest, wonderful Wehrmacht people. But when you get into war, things happen. Shit happens in war. You see your buddy shot down or disemboweled or whatever, it makes you mad and you want to kill somebody. And vice versa. When you see the Wehrmacht coming through your village there in Russia and lining people up and shooting them and stuff like that, it tends to piss people off. And they tend to join the partisans and go up in the woods, and when they come down out of the woods, they grab German soldiers and committed atrocities on them. But it's vice versa. It happens all the time in war. Like I told you the other day, my friend saw all these German soldiers with mutilated bodies, or American soldiers with mutilated bodies in the Battle of the Bulge. But Wehrmacht guy do atrocities on an American soldier. But there were all kinds of atrocities and crap done by American soldiers and British soldiers on the Germans. I'll get it straight, boys. Stay with me. I guess I'm too apprehensive about Santa Claus coming tonight. I can't get anything straight today. Well, let's look at a little declassified Cold War files. Show disturbing nuclear targets of population centers. Just like we did in World War II, right? Bomb all the working class neighborhoods of Germany. And Germans destroying working class neighborhoods of Poland, and England destroying working class neighborhoods of Germany, and, you know, the whole thing. So let's look at this. They declassified some of this stuff. The National Security Archive on Wednesday, for the first time, declassified a list of potential Cold War nuclear targets. And the picture is chilling. Among the industrial infrastructure and military sites that analysts concluded would achieve high levels of damage for the Soviet Union is one particularly troubling type of a target. It's called population. It's disturbing for sure to see the population centers targeted. William Burr, a nuclear historian and senior analyst at the National Security Archive, told the New York Times. The SAC, Strategic Air Command Atomic Weapons Requirements Study of 1959, is broken into two lists: air power, referring to airfields and other military sites, and systematic destruction, which refers to targets in urban industrial areas, including population targets. The study lists 1,200 cities total, from East Germany to China, with established priorities. While it was not a final list for military targets, the Strategic Air Command file shows that analysts developed a plan for the systematic destruction of Soviet bloc urban industrial targets that specifically and explicitly targeted populations in all the cities, including Beijing, Moscow, Leningrad, East Berlin, and Warsaw, the archives noted. In an essay that accompanied the SAC study, Burr writes, in other words, people as such, not specific industrial activities, were to be destroyed. Burr notes that such targeting reflects the tactical thinking about the impact of the bombing raids on civilian morale. Burr cites 1940 talk given by Major Muir Fairchild to the Air Corps Tactical School, in which he argued that an attack on a country's economic structure must be so to reduce the morale of the enemy's civilian population through fear of death or injury for themselves or loved ones, so that they would prefer our terms of peace to continuing the struggle, and that they would force their government to capitulate. Despite this, Burr notes, such attacks were inconsistent with the standards followed by Air Force leaders and violated norms of engagement and eventually international law. Quote, while they were willing to accept mass civilian casualties as a consequence of attacking military targets, as was the case with the Korean War, they ruled out intentional attacks on civilians. Burr continues, moreover, attacks on populations violated the international legal norms of the day, which were summarized in the then unratified Hague Rules on Aerial Warfare, 1923. Nevertheless, such targeting rules were not enforced until 1977, agreement on the additional protocols to the Geneva Convention from 1949. However, Burr notes that the U.S. has consistently refused to accept claims that the targeting standards of the additional protocols apply to the use of nuclear weapons, unquote. According to the Plowshares Fund, the current U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile is 7,200 weapons, second in the world to Russia, which holds 7,500. The files were obtained by the National Security Archive, a research group at George Washington University, through a journalist who filed a mandatory declassification review request to the National Archives and the Records Administration for specific files and records of the Strategic Air Command. So there you got it. They'll say, no, we don't bomb civilians, but they target civilians, just like they're targeting civilians in Syria. I mean, they're destroying the entire infrastructure with this bombing, and they're doing it to every country in the Middle East, and that's what they've done, did in World War II, did it in Vietnam, did it in Korea, and they had all those atomic weapons ready to go, and we're just very, very fortunate they didn't go. So your government, when they talk about caring about people, they're lying. They care about the system. They care about the ruling class. They care about all their money they've got and property and so forth. And that's it. If you get in the way of that, they don't give a shit who you are. They'll wipe you out en masse. Incidentally, the information I gave you yesterday was created by Lysander Spooner. And it was printed in 1852. But it's excellent, and it's right to the point. And if you're ever going to get a country back in shape, a white man's country, you're going to have to use those tactics to do it. Now, it's impossible right now because we're really under a police state rule. But if a revolution ever comes and you get a chance to reemploy what should not have ever gotten rid of, this essay on trial by jury should be in the pocket of every citizen in the country. And anybody that tries to get rid of it should be shot. Well, here's a fun thing for Christmas. A present everybody should want. Every Christmas sees one toy emerge as the most wanted, gotta have gift. Remember Tickle Me Elmo and Beanie Babies from years past? Well, 2015's big hit has emerged. The Iraq Syria Lego playset. The set retails for $3 trillion, though the price may have doubled by the time this is published. Included in the standard set are enough Legos to build replicas of Mosul, Fallujah, allowing a child to refight these battles over and over. Figures include Sunni militias, Islamic State fighters, Shia militias. One figure represents the actual Iraqi army, American special forces with and without boots, Iranians, Kurds, Turks, Russians, Syrians, moderate and radical, though they cannot be told apart, British, French, and Italian troops, shady Saudi financiers, and Hezbollah soldiers. The basic set also includes a starter pack of refugee figures, though most people will want to opt for the bonus pack, if only to get access to the limited edition dead children refugee figures. Not included, any weapons of mass destruction. Okay. While the Iraq-Syria Lego playset will provide any child with decades of fun, even more adventures can be played out by buying the Turkish expansion pack. And parents, please note, even after careful construction with the best intention, the playset tends to simply fall apart. Mama, Tommy wants one. Mama, Tommy wants one. Well, there's been a lot of consternation expressed in the media at a series of statements by Republican presidential candidates during their most recent debate and elsewhere, in which a number of them appear to be advocating a large-scale killing of civilians through aerial bombardment as a legitimate means of defeating the so-called Islamic State. Sounds familiar. Sounds like a replay of World War II, huh? These statements did not rationalize military operations that result in large numbers of civilian deaths. Politicians in both parties have supported for decades. But actually, advocate the killing of civilians as a legitimate tactic counter terrorism warfare. Whoa, the psychopaths right again. Let's put aside for a moment the irony of killing innocent people as a means of fighting a terrorist group, so-called terrorist group, that kills innocent people. and the fact that it would result in a blowback that would almost certainly increase the threat of terrorist attacks against the good old United States. Such operations would constitute a flagrant violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Who gives a shit about that? They don't care about that. And other principles of international law to which the United States, like all governments and armed groups, are legally bound. Oh, yeah, man. Everybody disobeys the law. Nobody goes to jail. Except poor people. Yet the three leading Republican candidates for president are bothered about that. Donald Trump has called on killing families of terrorist suspects. Ted Cruz has called on carpet bombing Syrian cities controlled by ISIS and see if sand can glow in the dark. Boy, that's a beautiful thought. When moderator Hugh Hewitt asked Ben Carson, "So you're okay with the deaths of thousands of innocent children and civilians?" unquote. He responded, "You got it. You got it." Governor Jeb Bush, a supposedly moderate voice in the debate, moderately weak, as Trump would say, underscored Republican hostility to international humanitarian law in his criticism of the Obama administration's failure to take more aggressive action in civilian populated areas, saying they would get the lawyers off the backs of the fighting forces and let them kill people. Although more liberal commentators have expressed appropriate outrage at such remarks, they have to fail to note that for a number of years now, prominent Democrats have also been advocating these very dangerous ideas as well, with the Democratic leaders also defending the large-scale killing of civilians in the name of fighting terrorism. Among the most outspoken Democrats who've defended the killing of civilians in areas controlled by terrorist groups, exonerated those responsible for specific war crimes, and advocating the effect rewriting the international humanitarian law to legitimize the killing of civilians has been former Senator and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The forerunner of the 2016 Democrat presidential nomination. For example, in response to concern raised by Israeli and international human rights groups about the nearly 1,500 civilians killed by the Israeli Jewish forces during the 2014 on the Gaza Strip, Hillary Clinton insisted, "I think Israel did what it had to do to respond to Hamas rockets," unquote. When pressed further about civilian casualties, she replied, "Israel has a right to defend itself," unquote, implying that she believed that attacks on civilians somehow constituted a legitimate self-defense. I'm telling you, we got the most radical, sociopathic, psychopathic killers you ever want to see running for president. Not that we haven't had them in Washington all along, but it's usually not all of them agreeing with the same thing. When Israeli forces attacked a UN school housing refugees in the Gaza Strip in July 2014, killing dozens of civilians, Senator Bernie Sanders condemned it, and the U.S. State Department issued a statement saying that it was appalled by the disgraceful shelling. By contrast, Hillary Clinton, when asked about the attack during an interview with The Atlantic magazine, refused to criticize the massacre, saying, quote, "It's impossible to know what happens in the fog of war," unquote. Though investigators found no evidence of Hamas equipment or military activity anywhere near the school, Clinton falsely alleged that Hamas was firing rockets from an annex to the school. Oh, they're putting all these guys in the prisons there in the country for stealing a six-pack of beer or smoking a joint. More tellingly, she appeared to argue that since Hamas had been firing rockets into civilian populated areas of Israel, the Israeli Jew government was not legally or morally culpable for their killing of Palestinian civilians, claiming that the ultimate responsibility for the deaths at the school has to rest on Hamas and the decision it made. Wow. In reality, however wrong, Hamas has been in firing rockets into Israel. Such actions simply do not absolve Israel of its responsibility under international humanitarian law. So what? For the far greater civilian deaths its armed forces have inflicted on Palestinians in Gaza. Indeed, it has long been a principle of Western jurisprudence that someone who is an approximate cause of a crime cannot claim innocence simply because of the influence of another party. For example, if someone starts a bar fight and a person ends up shooting him and a group of innocent bystanders, the shooter cannot claim innocence because the other guy initiated the conflict. Yet the front runner for the Democrat presidential nomination has repeatedly defended Israeli Jew military campaigns that have resulted in the deaths of more than 4,000 Lebanese and Palestinian civilians during the past 15 years in the name of self-defense against terrorism, criticizing findings by the human rights monitors and the international jurists and investigative journalists, as well as by Israeli veterans and human rights organizations, demonstrating otherwise as being flawed and biased. Well, meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, where all the crooks and criminals hang out, there has been a bipartisan effort to redefine international humanitarianism law to justify the large-scale killing of civilians. Well, there was one terrorist in that bunch of 1,000 people, so we had to kill them all. Well, I don't understand why you're bitching. For example, recent years have seen a series of resolutions passed by lopsided bipartisan majorities defending Israel Jews' attacks on civilian areas in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and Lebanon that have attempted to exonerate the U.S.-backed Jew-Israel armed forces for the thousands of civilians' casualties, which have greatly outnumbered military casualties, by the claim that the Arab militia groups were using human shields. International humanitarian law defines human shields as the deliberate use of civilians to deter attacks on one's troops or military objects. Investigations by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the United Nations Human Rights Council, and the U.S. Army War College, and others have failed to find a single documented case of any civilian deaths caused by Hamas, Hezbollah, or other Arab militant groups using human shields while fighting Jew-Israeli forces. These investigations have documented other war crimes by these groups, including not taking all the necessary steps it should to prevent civilian casualties when it positions fighters and armaments too close to concentrations of civilians. However, this is not the same thing as deliberately using civilians as shields. As a result, a 2009 resolution drawn up by the House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, the bitch from California that I bumped bellies with, attempted to exonerate Israel for the hundreds of civilian deaths inflicted by its armed forces by redefining what constitutes human shields. Sounds like Clinton when they were asking him, what does is mean? Is? The resolution called on the international community to condemn Hamas for deliberately embedding its fighters, leaders, and weapons in private homes, schools, and mosques, hospitals, and otherwise using Palestinian civilians as human shields. Well, Gaza is not very big. I was just over there. I saw Gaza. It's, where are they going to go? I mean, it's crazy the logic these people use. People act like this Gaza is a giant place. Israel, the whole Israel itself is a little pipsqueak piece of land. However, the fact that a Hamas leader lives in his own private home, attends a neighborhood mosque, and seeks admittance to the local hospital does not constitute embedding them for the purpose of using Palestinians as human shields. Indeed, the vast majority of leaders of most governments and political parties live in private homes and civilian neighborhoods, go to local houses of worship, and check into hospitals when sick or injured, along with ordinary civilians. Furthermore, given that the armed wing of Hamas is a militia rather than a standing army, virtually all its fighters live in private homes and go to neighborhood mosques and local hospitals. In short, this resolution, passed by an overwhelming 390-5 vote, puts both political parties on record advancing a radical and dangerous reinterpretation of international humanitarian law that would allow virtually any country with superior air power and long-range artillery to get away with war crimes. In the eyes of both Republicans and Democrats in Congress, Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip, the ISIS-controlled city of Raqqa, or other urban areas controlled by recognized terrorist organizations should be considered a free fire zone. What neither the Republic or the Democrats leaders have acknowledged, however, is that even if a terrorist group were using human shields in the narrower legal definition of the term, it still does not absolve armed forces from their obligation to avoid civilian casualties. Protocol 1 of the 4th Geneva Convention makes clear that even if one side is shielding itself behind civilians, such a violation shall not release the parties to the conflict from their legal obligations with respect to civilian population and civilians. You know how much the Pentagon pays attention to this. The Pentagon don't give a shit. For example, if it's a botched bank robbery resulting in the robbers holding bank personnel and customers hostage and firing at police from inside the building, it still would not legitimate for a SWAT team to kill the hostages as well because they were being used as human shields. Well, that's happened quite a few times, too. They never talk much about it. These efforts by Hillary the bitch Clinton and congressional bastard leaders to both broaden the definition of the human shields and legitimize the killing of civilians as a response is quite troubling. Yeah, very troubling, especially at a time of growing militarization of police here in the United States and the increasing concerns over their use of excessive force against unarmed civilians. It also serves as a troubling reminder that the comments like those heard at the Republican debate and elsewhere are becoming more acceptable among political leaders of both parties. Well, I say all those candidates that make those statements are nearly guilty of criminal conspiracy. That many people all saying to kill a civilian, that's criminal conspiracy. Indeed, a House passed resolution in July 2014 absolved Jew Israel for responsibility for the large-scale civilian casualties inflicted by its armed forces in the Gaza Strip due to the alleged use of human shields by Hamas. Also declared correctly in these cases that the Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Islamic State of Iraq, and the Levant ISIS and other foreign terrorist organizations typically use innocent civilians as human shields. The inclusion of that clause in a resolution defending the killing of civilians under such circumstances appears to have been designed to pave the way for just the kind of military onslaught on civilian areas of Syria and Iraq that the Republican candidates have in mind. Yeah. Oh boy. How can they put anybody in prison in this country? I mean, they can legitimize a murderer, I guess, under most conditions, but putting anybody else in prison when you compare them to these warmonger criminals in our government and even candidates running for office and running for the presidency, like that Graham Cracker, that little son of a bitch that just dropped out of the race, he's a madman. He would love to have blood on his hands. I want to send that little shit ass over there to the Middle East and put him on the front lines. Hey, go ahead and attack ISIS. Take care of it, Graham Cracker, you little shit. He is really scary, that guy. Yeah. Well, I see another Jew billionaire is taking over a big newspaper. Oh, boy, all these newspapers are owned by a few corporations. Now that casino magnate and billionaire right-winger Sheldon Adelson has been outed as the mystery buyer of an influential Nevada newspaper, a watchdog group is demanding that the publication appoint an independent public editor to monitor conflicts of interest and ethical breaches. Quote, vigorous independent journalism is vital to the health of a democracy. Todd O'Boyle, director of Common Causes Media and Democracy Reform Initiative, said Tuesday, responding to Adelson's purchase of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. While the First Amendment protects Mr. Adelson's right to buy the paper and to direct its operation, citizens should exercise their right to demand that he operate it in the public interest or openly declare that the reporting from his publication will be slanted. Oh, newspapers with slanted editorial? I don't think there is one that doesn't have that. I know the one in the town I live in or next to is so slanted. It's totally Republican dominated, and it's amazing what they get away with and editorialize always on pro-war and things like that. And they put some of the, you know, I'm no friend of Obama, but the cartoons they put in our local paper against Obama is just beyond anything. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I believe in being fair even to a black guy. I mean, you know, the cartoons they put in are absolutely, you know, if I try to put a cartoon like that in the paper, they wouldn't print it, I'll tell you. So anyhow, now we got this whack job billionaire made all his money screwing people out of their money gambling, and that's getting ridiculous. And behind all these Indian gambling casinos, there's a whole bunch of Jews behind every one of them. Evidently, Adelson paid $140 million for that Las Vegas newspaper. How about that? Now this is really gets funny. But then, late last week, Fortune published the explosive revelation that Adelson, a controversial figure, had orchestrated the sale and structured it through his son-in-law, Patrick Dumont, the current senior vice president of finance and strategy at Adelson's Las Vegas Sands Corporation. You know, these billionaires, this is all built on stupid people, white people included, gambling their money away, gambling it away. Senior citizens gambling away all their Social Security money. Adelson's family soon confirmed the purchase, claiming that they kept the sale secret because they did not want an announcement to distract from the important role Nevada continues to play in the 2016 presidential elections. Earlier this week, the Review Journal ran an editorial reflecting on the potential implications for the paper, which they say has a conservative libertarian tilt, or they're using those terms very loosely, concluding that the publication could see some major editorial shifts from a complete reversal on its drug policy positions to a noticeable shift on defense spending. Well, that's enough of that bullshit. I see this whacked out nigger broad that killed those people in Las Vegas who drove right down the sidewalk mowing them down like damn bowling pins. They said she appeared in court. She's distraught. She don't look distraught to me. She looks like she's challenging everybody. She looks like she's don't give a shit and she's glad she did it. So there's a terrorist. These people that do things like that, they're terrorists. I mean, they're just as much terrorists as ISIS. Let's see what happened in court.
Letitia Holloway.
Joe Booth versus President Kosky.
So, for the record, I appointed the public defender 2 days ago.
That's correct.
Hello, Mr. Sabrakma.
How are you?
I'm fine. Just stand right there. Do you have a copy of the criminal complaint and waive its reading, Mr. Booth?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
All right. And would you like to preliminary hearing, set new one here in court, or 15 days?
Actually, Your Honor, I think, as Your Honor probably knows, there's going to be a number of additional charges that we anticipate. The state's still investigating. Obviously, we'd like to run some independent investigation. We're requesting a 30-day status check for the purpose of setting a preliminary hearing.
Okay. Ms. Holloway, do you understand and agree with that? You have a right to a preliminary hearing within 15 days of today's date. However, Mr. Booth has told me due to the complexity of the case that you're willing to waive that 15-day period and instead set this for a 30-day status check and then we'll set your preliminary hearing. You agree with that? Okay. Here's a 30-day status check and we'll reset this. But we'll set preliminary hearing at that time. What day are you giving me? Yeah, that's fine.
January 20th, 8 a.m.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. One thing for the record.
Yes.
The original plea had the victim's name on an account to set the building and you were able to confirm.
Well, anyhow, that was the background noise to the plea of this Holloway nigger broad that killed those people and run over a whole bunch of them in Las Vegas. She doesn't show any remorse at all. She didn't even say yes or no. She just shook her head. People like that, as far as I'm concerned, why don't they bomb people like that? I mean, you know, with airplanes. I mean, you know, instead of civilians over there in the Middle East. You take her out in the middle of the desert and get a drone on her. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to do it, but it should be something that's considered. Now, thanks to our man in Las Vegas, I'm sending you this news article from the Journal Review in Las Vegas. And with all the pictures of this bitch, and look at her, does she seem distraught? Does she seem even apologetic? Hell no. She's just acting like a typical hood nigger. Well, we got some good news to report. The black KKK in Chicago is doing a pretty good job. Numerous reports from Chicago locals have confirmed that King Louis was shot in the Windy City earlier today. While details remain scarce, Louis' manager has confirmed with Chicago Sun-Times writer Charles Perry that the rapper is alive and talking. The near-fatal shooting happened near 83rd and Pulaski in Chicago. Stay tuned for more details. Well, the fact that he's alive can be contributed to the fact that he got shot in the head because there's nothing in there. Here's another cool Negro story. Former NFL player who made $40 million over his career just filed for bankruptcy. Oh, jeez. What does it say here? Let's see. That's a different kind of black KKK. Former NFL running back Clinton Portis has filed for bankruptcy just 5 years after retiring from the league. Portis, who made $40 million over the course of his nine-year career, he made $40 million in 9 years and he's bankrupt, has a long list of creditors, including the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas. He owes them $287,000. He owes the IRS $458,000. His mother, he owes his mother $500,000. Jesus Christ. According to NBC Sports, bad investments led to Portis' downfall as he lost $8 million on a failed casino and another $2 million to a Ponzi scheme. Portis had nearly 12,000 all-purpose yards and 80 touchdowns playing for the Denver Broncos and the Washington Redskins. Well, anyhow, that's the way that goes. The Jews got the money, I'll bet you, most of it. Well, the documents have shown new light on Jeb Bush's role in freeing a Cuban terrorist. Gee whiz, I thought that those people were law and order people. Orlando Bosch, in custody after his arraignment in Hartford, Connecticut in 1965, and Jeb Bush in 1980, pictures. Whoa, wait a minute here. an international terrorist enters the United States illegally with no visa, FBI agents alert their superiors. The suspect is linked to more than 40 bombings, including the blowing up of a civilian airliner. He makes it clear he has no intention on renouncing violence to achieve his goal. It's a scenario that today would have public officials and politicians of all stripes expressing outrage and demanding that the suspect be booted out immediately or locked up indefinitely. But 25 years ago, the accused terrorist in question, a fiery white-haired Cuban exile by the name of Orlando Bosch, was freed by the U.S. government in a deal cleared by the White House, thanks in part to the backing he received from the president's son, Jeb Bush. You got to trust this guy to take care of terrorism? The story of Jeb Bush and Orlando Bosch is from another era in the U.S.-Cuba relations when passions about Fidel Castro's regime ran high in South Florida. For many Cuban Americans, Bosch was a symbol of anti-communist resistance. A pediatrician turned freedom fighter who, after receiving early backing from the CIA, had dedicated his life to overthrowing the Cuban government by any means necessary. "I am a fighter and a patriot. In a war, everything is valid," he told Anne Louis Bardock, a journalist who interviewed Bosch extensively for her book. The book title was Without Fidel, the Death, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. When the Justice Department in the summer of 1989 moved to deport Bosch from the country, labeling him an unrepentant terrorist and a danger to the community, Bush, then Miami businessman, who had served as a chairman of the Dade County Republican Party, was among a number of local political figures who rushed to his defense, even making a highly publicized visit to meet with Bosch's diabetic brother, who was then on a hunger strike protesting the decision. Bush's backing of Bosch received media attention at the time, but documents recently reviewed by the Yahoo News in the presidential library of President George H.W. Bush and in the Justice Department archives shed new light on this case, revealing how political interests, including a congressional race in which Jeb Bush was the campaign manager, influenced his father's White House to ultimately arrange for Bosch to win his freedom. Now, here's a guy who was involved in airplane bombings and everything else. You see? You know, if you're in the loop, you're okay. You can kill anybody you want. Mr. Bosch clearly has a broad-based support in the community, White House staffers Sik Unseev and Sherry Sanchez wrote in June 1989. Memo to the president mentioning that among his key supporters was your son, Jeb. Now he wants to be president? Ha ha ha. Siv and Sanchez wrote that the Justice Department decision to deport Bosch had created a difficult political atmosphere in Miami. They complained that the Justice Department had failed to show any political sensitivity in its handling of the Bosch case and warned about potentially damaging fallout. Quote, "The time of this decision has further complicated our hopes for a Republican victory in the special election for Claude Pepper's seat in late August," you see. They wanted to get the Cuban exile vote, so they were going to let this guy go. No problem. We just want to get our man into the Congress or the Senate. They wrote, referring to an upcoming election in which the congressional campaign of the GOP candidate, then State Senator Lena Ross Layton, running for the seat of the recently deceased Democratic Congressman Claude Pepper, would be managed by Jeb Bush. Yeah. The White House staffers recommended that the White House officials meet with Bosch's supporters at the White House and discuss ways by which the Justice Department can be more responsive to their concerns. 3 weeks later, President Bush flew on Air Force One with Bosch's leading supporter, Ross Layton, to campaign for her in Miami. She later told reporters she pressed the president to free Bosch on humanitarian grounds. Yeah, it don't matter if he blows up airplanes, kills people, as long as he's on our side. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, God. Well, boys and girls, if you don't mind, this gets so nauseating, I got to take a break. I got to get ready to say hi to Santa Claus. I hope he's not a terrorist. I hope he's not working with ISIS. But see, if you're rich and powerful or have rich and powerful friends, you can get away with anything. Anything at all you can get away with.
Won't bleed in the damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. forget to fall through the cracks. Let him eat jelly beans, let him eat cake, let him eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo, look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, or Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains. That's done closed down along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. Dust devils dance in the noonday heat. There's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. We can't make it here.